Gas holders.
What are gas holders and how do we mark engineering heritage when technology moves on? I'm Richard Harwood, a barrister at 39 Essex Chambers.
And I'm Clarissa Levy, Art and Heritage Council at Wedlake Bell.
And we're delighted to have with us Professor Russell Thomas, who's a technical director of WSP. Hello, Russell.
Hi.
And Timur Tatlioğlu, partner and head of Montagu Evans Historic Environment and Townscape team. Hello, Timur.
Hi.
They're the editors of a new book, Gas Holders, A History in Pictures, which, with the assistance of National Grid and Historic England, contains absolutely stunning photographs of the past, present and future of gas holders. So first of all, can we start, particularly for any members of the audience under the age of about 50, by asking what are gas holders and what was their role?
A gas holder was a vital part of the gas infrastructure. Its main role was to balance out the diurnal changes, or changes between day and night, in gas consumption and gas production. So if you were producing gas from a former gasworks, which I'll go on to explain how it worked, then you'd be producing gas in the evening when people weren't using it. And then you'd use that gas to fill up the gas holders. And then in the day, in the morning, when people were cooking their breakfasts or having a wash, then the gas demand would increase and the gas holders would gradually empty of gas. And then the cycle would be repeated on a daily basis.
And the nature of it is actually that this is not initially, we're not talking about natural gas taken from the ground, but gas that's manufactured. Do you want to just help us with how that came about?
So gas manufacture was developed at the very end of the 18th century and into the start of the 19th century by the Scottish engineer, primarily William Murdoch. He had worked out, as many other coal philosophers as they were called before him, that if you heated coal in the absence of oxygen, then the coal would break down and it would release a gas which was flammable. Initially, that gas was used for lighting and the gas had to be purified because it contained toxic elements such as sulfur and cyanide and ammonia. So there was a whole set of processing plant developed that was used for purifying this gas. And that's what you would find on a gasworks itself, various sequential processes for cleaning the gas and then storing it.
So the gasworks would have a building or series of buildings where the processing is done, and it'll have the gas holders in terms of the big steel frames, usually steel frame structures or iron frame structures, where the gas will be stored to balance off the fact, presumably, that the gasworks is going 24/7, but the actual usage of gas will vary during the course of the day.
Very much so, yes.
And how numerous were these sites?
Well, the study that we did for Historic England found there were 3,600 former gas sites just in England alone. I think there are another 800 in Scotland and about 500 in Wales. So quite a large number. Each of these sites would have had a gas holder of some sort associated with it.
And that sort of feels remarkable because the ones that come to mind, I mean, remember as a child sort of coming into London on a train to St Pancras from the Midlands, you see the big gas holders at King's Cross there, and many people will be familiar with the gas holders in the background at the Oval Cricket Ground. But the idea that they were up and down the country, would a village necessarily have had a gas works potentially?
Yes, so I mean, one particular example is Lavenham, a village in Suffolk that still has its protected gas holder, but that would have had its own small gas works, which just supplied that village at the time. So initially, every city, town and large villages had their own gasworks and small gas network. They weren't interconnected as we see the gas supply today.
Would the gas holders have been to common designs? Were they typical designs or was there something a bit different?
It was a design that kept evolving over time. So there's different typologies depending on time and construction materials available. So most early or very early gas holders, so just down the road from here in Fleet Street, a small gasworks built for the printer Rudolf Ackermann, who you will find in a drawing of his gasworks in a book from 1816. It's a square gas holder. And these early holders often used cast iron in the framing. They were very heavy framing, so sometimes needed to be counterbalanced to reduce the excess pressure. And some of the early ones also had wooden tanks, old brewers' vats, and with the noxious substances that built up in the tanks, they happened to rot and collapse over time. So they went for below-ground tanks after that, made from brick.
How far is this a British phenomenon, or is it something which we see elsewhere?
The original gas holder dates back to the French chemist Lavoisier, who used them for collecting gases from his pneumatic chemistry experiments. How they came to the UK was that a chap called Thomas Beddoes was developing the Pneumatic Medicine Institute in Bristol, and he got Boulton and Watt to make small gasometers for him to feed people these different gases. And from that, as Boulton and Watt were the employers of William Murdoch, who developed the first gas plants, they realised that you could make this same device much larger and then use it for commercial applications for gas storage. So without that buffer, then the gas industry would have never been economical from the start.
What's happened to gas works and gas holders since the Second World War? How have things moved on?
The main change was around 1949, when the gas industry was nationalised, and then there was a total change. So we went from this approach that each town, city, or large village had its own gas works and gas network, to there being a drive for efficiency. So the gas undertakings, private and public, were split up between 12 area boards in Great Britain, not Northern Ireland, but Great Britain. And these area boards were then charged with making gas more efficiently and cost-effectively. So they would build much larger gas works and then supply that gas through a new network that would cover their region, which would be gradually built up over the following years. Whether those small gas works got connected, then the gas works would close there and the holders would be retained for a period of time before the gas network was reinforced and they were no longer needed. So they've gradually been disappearing over this time.
Then we've had the introduction of natural gas. So gasworks themselves entirely redundant in that no one makes gas from coal these days?
No, the last similar process was coke manufacture, and the last of the coke ovens in Great Britain have closed now. It's still produced and it's very similar, that you bake coal in an oven over time and it releases gas, but the end product they were after was coke. We did go through a brief period between 1960s and 70s where we made gas from oil because coal was getting rarer and too expensive. So we transitioned in this period before we switched to natural gas to making gas from oil, and that was cleaner and had less of the toxic component of carbon monoxide, which we probably should stress is one of the major differences between manufactured gas and natural gas, that there was a large component of carbon monoxide and hydrogen in town gas, as well as methane that you find in natural gas.
So the gas works closed. Was there still a value in gas holders as a means of storage?
Yes, they still worked in the same principle as they had before. You still had this diurnal change of demand for gas, and the gas holders were still there to balance out that demand. But there were still, I think, around 1,800 of them in 1981, many years after we'd switched to natural gas.
Are they still being used for storage?
Not on the gas work today. They're redundant. There's one, I think, in Scotland that's on a network, an isolated network in the islands of Scotland. But apart from that, the storage that you would have had, diurnal storage you would have had in gas holders, is now within the high pressure tiers of the distribution and transmission network. So it's, I think, called line pack, and they can withdraw from this extra pressure they have in the network to meet these demands. So they don't store a huge amount of gas relative to things where people are concerned about long-term days of gas storage. The country, it was only for a period of a day, really, that they helped out.
So we have historically thousands of sites in town cities, often on the edge of city centres, which were using a very toxic process. And we now want to find something useful to do with those sites. So how do you redevelop a former gas works? What are the challenges?
Well, it's very much a matter of dealing with the remaining process wastes that may be on the site, or byproducts. So substances such as coal tar is the main driver that may be interspersed in the soil on the site, or it may be still present within tanks. So over the years, these large structures have been taken away by the gas industry, and the toxic and potentially harmful elements have been removed from a position where they may come into contact with receptors, or potentially a receptor being a human receptor being something like groundwaters or surface waters, which may be ecological importance or use for drinking water. So it's mainly removing these major sources from the site.
And Timo, what sort of challenge does that give the development industry who are looking at bringing forward a new use on these sites?
Well, depending on the nature of the, or the extent of contamination on the land, you can have sites which were formerly used as gas works, or where there was gas production, which tend to be more contaminated than those where it was simply storage. But the costs involved with the remediation are considerable. You know, they run into the millions, and it can be greater depending on the size of the site. And in today's climate, where there is increased pressure on cost for construction, cost for all sorts of elements actually in the construction industry, it means that you have to find a viable and deliverable solution. So in a nutshell, these are very knotty sites that present a considerable challenge to redevelop, not least from the health and safety considerations that Russell was just referring to.
So that's quite a challenge to start off with. And then we've got a very large number of sites, 3,600 in England. In the main, those are in urban areas. To what extent is it important to conserve them?
Well, as we've already mentioned, gas holders were ubiquitous through town and city centres, which meant that they were part of the public conscious or even subconscious, because as we've alluded to already, many people are aware of them, but you know, don't necessarily know what they were for or why. They were as important, and the gas industry was as important as the arrival of the railways, you know, into this country and to the world, because gas lit the first street lamps, illuminated our homes, places of work. And as a result of that, there is a certain value attached to the structures. Now, not all gas holders are of the same value. And if I refer to the work that we started doing with National Grid back in 2010, where you had a considerable number of gas holders across the country, we looked at all of the sites across the country and looked at all of the gas holders at Montague Evans to consider the relative value. And we knew at that stage that with the pressure for the removal of gas holders for any number of new uses, but particularly the delivery of homes, these structures were likely to be, you know, noticed as they were taken down. So we went through this work and worked very closely with Historic England to understand which types were of particular value and which types were just part of that technological advancement, which, as Russell has already alluded to, every new gas holder was slightly better than the last. But where were the innovative jumps that meant that those particular types should be preserved in some way? Or there were particular circumstances like at Bromley by Bow, where there were seven, where there are seven listed gas holders, the only type in the world. And so we knew at that stage, and you know, I'm really proud of the work we've done with National Grid, because we identified the areas where some form of retention and preservation is the right approach. But then there are other areas where we committed to historic building recording of every single one of those gas holders voluntarily, irrespective of where there were planning conditions, architectural photography, public exhibitions, and as well as educational initiatives to really make sure that we're adding to the storehouse of understanding and capturing the stories associated with these structures.
So essentially it's one aspect of the Industrial Revolution, which in historic terms is one of Britain's great contributions, and it reflects in a lot of the World Heritage site designations, which are in the UK, are because of the Industrial Revolution. So anything has some intrinsic value, but there's an awful lot of sites. There is an attempt to preserve all of them, and it's identifying what's of particular value in situations where that they all seem to keep changing, they all add something to the knowledge of the industry. But having taken a view about relative importance and so on, how do you then work that into an approach which actually enables that site to be put into a productive, valuable use now?
So there are different types of sites. So geographically, as I've alluded to, but as well as the gas holders that have varying values. So you might have a site like Stratford, former Gasworks, which you've been working on with St William, which had two gas holders of limited value and which were demolished and they were taken down and as part of the prior approval process. But working with LLDC as it was, and a very good design team, we were always mindful of how you can tell the story of the place and the history of the place, not least because in that part of East London, the industrial sites had played a fundamental part in the local communities and how they grew. And there's lots of stories about people who are still alive who used to work on these sites. So in that type of project, we were looking at how the architecture responded to the architecture on the site historically, the historic types of buildings and industrial buildings on the site. So that's through materials, design, fenestration, and so forth. Landscape approach is landscape design. So where we've introduced materials and as well as the layout to respond to the former layout of gas holders on the site, as well as all the way through to the telemetry and pipework that's being reimagined as part of play. Now, that just helps somebody who comes onto that site with little understanding of what went before to be able to have some sense of the heritage context. And then you have other sites like Bromley by Bow, where there are very tangible markers of the history of Bromley by Bow Gasworks, and those seven gas holders will be retained. But then how do you respond to that and ensure that that narrative is legible for all those who come on to the site in the future?
We'll come to Bromley by Bow and the retention in a moment, but what were you saying about the Stratford example is interesting because I'm right in understanding that, in a sense, none of the original gasworks and the gas holders is retained, but what you sought to do is have a design which reflects that history. Is that part of creating a sense of place, a sense of character to this, which is different from what I think has been described as the London vernacular design of the sort of modern clad or sort of rendered flats, which are sort of been coming up in London over the last few decades?
I think in answer to that, the simple answer is yes, but it's a bit more complicated because most sites we work on, particularly if they are cleared sites or traditional redevelopment sites, there is some history, which, you know, in my role as a heritage and townscape consultant, we try and introduce into the narrative of the story we're telling about the new development. But these gas sites offer something a little bit different, which is that there is a quite an inherent industrial history and context that can be drawn upon, that is very recent as well. You know, that history lasts 150 years. And it is very much about creating a sense of place, as you've said. And the anchor in the industrial heritage is quite a straightforward one to draw on. Now, in these locations, there are other anchors around and responses that you have to draw on in contextually, not least for the local communities. But one thing to remember is these sites were often closed. They were at the heart of communities, but were often closed to those communities. So these developments offer an opportunity to open up for the first time in their history.
Yes, they're sort of there, but they're sort of shadowed doing over. You've got that presence, particularly the gas holder, which is what I think, certainly to my mind, what people remember about those. But they're in the community, but they're not, in the sense, part of it, unless you happen to work there. But it's so recent that you're not reflecting something which is, in a sense, stylized or idealistic or from the past, but something you can work from. That's one response. Of course, it loses what was there, but the retention scheme, particularly where we're dealing with listed structures, how do you retain and make use again of these items?
First of all, you start from a place where the challenge is really quite immense and complicated. There's these opportunities for these sites, particularly where the gas holders are going to be retained, of rebirth and renewal in a quite a unique way. But when you see the example at King's Cross, for example, where the triplets were refurbished, it's easy to forget that there's considerable complexity and you require specialist contractors who navigate the process of dismantling what are essentially brittle cast iron frames, having to undertake a condition survey of each structure, understanding the varying degrees of decay, and some of which you won't even know until you start to take the thing apart. So you may find even further decay, or you might find the other side, which is that some of the fabric might be better. And then the cast iron frames are carefully dismantled, taken to a specialist workshop, of which there is only one in the country, who can deal with these large structures, refurbish those structures, which involves cleaning, refurbishing, repair, and working through that process with Historic England in quite a high degree of minutiae, and then reinstating the gas holders for new uses for which they were never intended. Because bear in mind, these are unlike any other heritage asset. They are essentially for machinery that were designed with a frame for the bell to rise and fall, and they were certainly never intended to last the number of years that they have done. So you have to put them back in a new place, often with a new building at the centre of them, which comes at, as I said, a high degree of complexity and a certain cost associated with it as well. So the challenge for the developers who take these projects on is a high one. And actually, I think, you know, certainly they should be applauded for taking it on, because there's not many people who have the expertise to be able to do that.
The particular examples that come to mind are King's Cross, where we now have a block of flat within the gas holder frame. I was wondering if there's a ship in the bottle problem, but the gas holder's dismantled. And off, I'm actually thinking at King's Cross, the particular locations where they've been re-erected aren't actually the original locations.
That's correct. Yeah, they were dismantled, delisted, moved, refurbished, brought back on a different location, then relisted, which is just an interesting quirk of the listing process.
How technically can that be? Because I imagine, Ross, may have a view on this as well, that these were put up with the intention of fulfilling a function, and the engineers who put them up thought, well, technology is going to advance. If it all gets a bit decayed or it's a bit out of date, we'll just take it down and put another one up, rather than thinking that these are structures which in 150 years will still be up with the intention of being in place permanently.
Well, the engineers that designed them with the intention that it could be removed and taken down and built somewhere else. So certainly a lot of the above ground holders, so an example is Great Yarmouth, that holder was actually rebuilt before its current position, because where it was first built, the ground conditions were unstable due to the sand under the site. And you'll often see, if you go back through the gas journal, you'll see gas holder for sale. So somebody would take it down and sell it to somebody else. So very sustainable. I mean, it's like the byproducts they produce from the gasworks. Everything was sold and the money recovered if they could.
And in some cases went across the world.
Yes, the one that was at Blackfriars is a famous one that appears in a book called King's Treatise. It was actually re-erected in Calcutta, and there's photographs of it.
So you've got something which is, in a sense, bespoke, because these are designs, technologies moving on, but actually were put together in such a way that they could be dismantled and re-erected elsewhere.
Yeah, just maybe not 150 years later, after the effects of time and erosion and rust.
I know, exactly. And that's the challenge. And so I think in answer to your question about moving those to locations where they weren't necessarily originally intended, or you didn't have the bases or the foundations, well, the answer is yes, you can do that. The majority of the more recent cases, such as at Bethnal Green or Bromley by Bow, we've alluded to, the gas holders are being retained in the locations that they were built.
So what's the plan at Bromley by Bow?
We now have a planning permission where we work very closely with St William over the course of 4 years. I should say I've been involved with that site for 10 years because we were advising National Grid prior to that. And what was most important early on was to understand the significance of the site. So we used Historic England's enhanced listing service to update some of these listing descriptions that were, you know, only a paragraph or two or three sentences. And over the course of working very closely with London Borough of Newham, GLA and Historic England, we've got a scheme where all of the gas holders are being retained. And also one area that we don't often talk about are the below ground structures, the fabric, where you have the top of the bell, the crown. And in the case of Bromley by Bow, the almost umbrella-like structure will be taken out, refurbished, and then brought back and put on a location on one of the other gas holders on the site, which was lost, to celebrate that quite intricate structure, but also forms part of the listing. So there's two different ways that the fabric is being celebrated. And then overall, it's a residential-led redevelopment with mixed uses, but generally, you know, it is being seen as a real celebration and a best-in-class conservation-led redevelopment.
How advanced is that scheme at the moment?
We had a resolution to grant last July, if I remember, and at the moment we're moving through to discharging conditions and so forth. But you know, I have no doubt that our client is fully committed to delivering that site.
And the Kennington Oval we've already mentioned as one of the iconic scenes, and it is on the photograph on the front of the book, is of the gas holder in the background of a cricket match at the Oval in South London. What are the plans for that site?
We've only been involved very much arm's length, and initially we were advising SGN, who are the freeholders, rather than Barclay, who are redeveloping. But my understanding is the gas holder is being refurbished in situ and new residential development is being built within the gas holder.
The towers are going up in the centre of the gas holder at the moment, the concrete towers for the construction.
Yes, there's some wonderful CGI images in the book of various schemes, including Kennington, which is showing the flats sort of within the gas holder. How challenging is that exercise in terms of both for the construction within it, but also that we've got an old gas holder which we now need to presumably renovate in situ and make sure is good for the future?
Structurally, it's very challenging because with a column guided gas holder, as you see King's Cross or Bromley by Bow, each of the columns is inherently strong and can support its own weight. With a structure, as you see at the Oval or the recently refurbished Granton Gasworks, if you start to take those structures apart, they lose their inherent strength. You have to be very careful and mindful that you don't damage any of the cross membranes when you do it. So it requires great skill and ability. And those who are attempting this and have proven it's possible at Granton have got to be commended for their efforts. It's no small achievement trying to secure those types of structures.
There's an additional complexity, which is designing the buildings within the frame so that they meet building and housing standards, which in London is from the GLA, and the flats that you find or the apartments within or the homes that you find within those buildings are certainly bespoke. And how do you try and create a orthogonal form to meet the standards without having slightly odd shaped apartments, which first of all, how attractive will they be to a market? But equally, are you meeting standards? So when we were working with RSHP, both on Bethnal Green and Bromley by Bow, while the buildings within the structure look like they are round, they're not. They are slightly canted to create that form. There's also added complexities of creating enough space around the frame so that it can be maintained in the way that it needs to be over time, which means you need a gap. And how do you also create a relationship between the base of the new buildings and the frame so that people can interact with it? There's also a rhythm of the bays, which the buildings respond to as well. So you're not looking out from your new apartment and seeing a column sitting in front of it. So all of that has been very closely designed and considered.
Yeah, particularly the London housing standards are tough in design terms, trying to maximise dual aspect flats, creating an environment which not only looks good from the outside, but somewhere which people will actually want to live in at a value which enables a developer to go ahead with the project.
I think that there's an additional point which we haven't talked about, which is there is the development within the gas holder frames, but there's also other new buildings on the sites that we've been referring to, which all form part of the overall deliverability of the project. And how do you find a form of massing composition that responds to the setting and significance of listed gas holders? And in the case of Bromley by Bow, as we've been referring to, there is this sort of gradual change in height to ensure that actually the significance and the setting of the gas holders is preserved as best as possible.
So we're keeping a visibility and appropriate prominence whilst actually making the good use of the site. A final one I wanted to touch on is sort of Battersea Power Station, because I think there's a whole story in itself about the redevelopment of the power station, but there was a gas works close by, which whilst it was operating actually was, I think, quite a constraint on development in that area for safety reasons. But there have been attempts to reflect that in the Battersea Power Station redevelopment. How's that worked?
the former site, which was at Prince of Wales Drive, where I think, if I remember right, there were four gas holders. And we worked on the demolition applications. And then shortly afterwards, I think part of the Barclay Group then looked at redeveloping the site. Now, early on, as part of the cultural strategy working with the London Borough of Wandsworth, we agreed that part of one of the gas holders would be retained. And now when you go to the entrance to the site, you see these parts of the gas holders that have been retained. More broadly, I wasn't part of the design team to be talking to the way that the history of the site was translated into the buildings. But you do find in certain scenarios, and that's one of them, where there's salvaging of material to help try and tell a story. The other thing I'd say is, as part of the demolition, a number of parts of the gas holders, for example, there were shields that were part of the structure, were removed, which are very large, weighty objects, and given to local museums. And it was felt that it was right to preserve this fabric.
And we've mentioned the book a couple of times. Some people think it is fantastic. It's some superb photographs of gas holders from original conception to where we're going now. But do you want to take us through how the book's come about?
Okay. I think we should give the credit for Phil Edwards, who sponsored the project, and also very much behind the scenes, Nadia Dew and Philippa Mears, who did a lot of the policing of me to get the photographs together. So I trawled through the photograph collection of National Gas Archive, the Institute of Gas Engineers and Managers History Panel Archive, which luckily I chair that panel. And we were also given access to the Historic England Gas Archive and a few other people I know that have been interested in photographing gas holders have contributed. I think we got together about 5,000 different photographs. I initially wilted those down into a smaller collection, and I also formulated the basic structure of the book in going through an introduction, the evolution, and then the different types. One example we haven't mentioned are the high-pressure gas holders, which are a quirky and unusual kind of gas holder, the only types that are still in operation in the country today. And then there's this the final chapter, which Tim Moore had a strong involvement with, on seeing how, I suppose we were looking perhaps more at the past and how they were taken down, but it's more of a forward-looking chapter at the end now, how these will be remembered in England going forward.
I think it's also worth saying that when we started looking at these sites with National Grid 14 years ago, even at that early point, we talked about the opportunity of really celebrating the legacy of the gas industry and all of those who took the photographs, stored the archives, all of those individuals and companies and others that Russell and I are very grateful for, to really celebrate some of those stories. And a particular point where this is a real moment in the gas industry, moving from gas storage above ground to high pressure pipes underground, which is really the reason why the gas holders have been lost. And this was the culmination of many years' work and to tell that story. And it's something we're incredibly proud of.
I think something that comes over from the book is the stories. It has some absolutely stunning photographs from an engineering or possibly might say an architectural perspective of how these structures have looked, but it's also has some fabulous photos of work being carried out, of people making them, repairing them. A photograph entirely of women workers during one of the World Wars, chipping and repainting part of a gas holder and so on. So it's evocative of not simply the structures, but the people who were there. And partly the times, one really caught my eye is a photograph from, I think, 1950 of King's Cross, where in the foreground you've got a horse and cart, and in the background you've got two gas holders, and it's all a bit sort of London smoggy background. That's the sense of a juxtaposition of technology and history and change, which I think this topic reflects, and the book, to my mind, reflects very well. It's absolutely sort of fabulous work, and as you said, a team involved in putting it together. And it's been delightful to talk to both of you today about this particular work and this particular topic. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Art and Heritage Law Contested Heritage. Please do follow or subscribe on Apple or Spotify podcasts to enjoy more shows.
We have a new podcast out every fortnight. If you're able, please take the time to rate us and put down a review.
The show is also on the 39 Essex Chambers website, along with podcast series on topics such as artificial intelligence, climate change, and planning.